Welcome to the Nonfiction Podcast. I'm Matt Buzateri. This is episode number 16, and once again, thank you so much for listening. If you've been enjoying the show, or if you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment and review and rate it on iTunes. Podcasts always ask that, but it really does make a difference. It'll help more people discover the show and help more people find out about this. So if you can spare a minute now or after listening, please rate the show on iTunes. One other thing I wanted to add before I start the show, and that's just about long-form journalism in general. The guest today is from the Washington Post. And recently this year, I made a commitment to supporting the kind of nonfiction that I really appreciate for two reasons, really. First of all, as you know, I run this podcast. I love long-form nonfiction. And one of the ways you can support this right now in a time when magazines and newspapers are really struggling is to subscribe. So I subscribe already to The New Yorker. But this year, I committed myself to subscribing both to the digital editions of The Washington Post and The New York Times. I was surprised that it really isn't that expensive. It's probably less than a dollar a week for all the great reporting and journalism and writing. And you can also support any other range of magazines, whether it's The Atlantic or GQ or Harper's, you name it. Wherever you find really good creative narrative nonfiction, I really suggest that you consider subscribing to support that kind of journalism. Secondly, I don't typically get very political on this show, although those who know me are very aware that I have very strong political beliefs. But I think with the current political situation, especially in the United States, the existence of the free press and good investigative reporting is definitely under threat. I think the actual idea of objective truth and facts are under threat. And so now more than ever is a great time to support publications and newspapers that are dedicated to both of those things. So that's my pitch. I don't get any percentage of it. I just think it's important to share because if you're like me and you really love great nonfiction, great reporting, great writing, it really helps to put your money where your mind is and support it. So with all that said, let's get on with the show. On this episode, I talk with John Woodrow Cox from the Washington Post about his story, Telling JJ. The story appeared in the Washington Post in September 2015, and it is about a 10-year-old girl who is about to learn that she has been HIV positive since birth. The author of the piece, John Woodrow Cox, is a reporter at the Washington Post, and prior to joining the Post, he worked at the Tampa Bay Times and the Valley News. Here is a brief excerpt from the story. Since the AIDS epidemic erupted in the 1980s, hundreds of children born with HIV have been brought to this hospital for treatment by medical specialists who become surrogate aunts and uncles. The doctors, nurses, and therapists buy them birthday gifts, attend their graduations, and teach them how to take pills. They monitor their life-defining numbers and strategize against a relentless virus for which no cure exists. They keep them alive. They do all of this without telling their youngest patients why. And when the time to tell them does come as they reach puberty, the staff plans for weeks how to do it, debating whether the kids are ready to know, whether they can handle it. And now they hope that JJ could handle it, because she was about to learn the truth. The night before she walked into the waiting room, her mother, Lee, had lain in bed and prayed. Her stomach tightened as JJ, who often climbed in with her, slept on Lee's shoulder. She knew what was at stake. Because of the vicious stigma still attached to HIV, doctors at Children's would deliver the news with a pair of contradictory directives. Don't be ashamed, but keep the virus a secret. Her baby girl had long suffered through torrents of fear and sadness. How JJ would respond to this disclosure about her illness, no one knew. If you haven't already read this story, the link to the article is in the show notes and on the podcast website at nonfictionpodcast.com. Go ahead and pause the show. Come back after you've read it. And now, here's the interview. I'm talking with John Woodrow Cox, a reporter with the Washington Post. He's the author of Telling JJ. John, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
This story actually is from 2015, and it is one of these narrative nonfiction pieces that kind of stuck with me a long time after I read it. So I'm really excited to talk to you about how this came to be. I guess that's kind of my first question. How did you find out about this young girl who was finding out for the first time that she had HIV? And then how did you wind up being able to basically spend almost half a year reporting this?
So the origin really started even a couple of years earlier. My editor, Linda Robinson, had seen a story by, I think, like a local radio station. They had just done a web story about the doctors at All Children's Hospital who care for these kids. And there was just one line buried deep in the story that said that they typically disclose their illness to them when they're around age 12 or 13. And that stuck with her, my editor. She just thought, oh, wow, wouldn't it be amazing to see that or to recreate that? And another reporter, I think, had taken a run at it. And then I came to the Post in September of 2014. And in a really early discussion about potential story ideas, that one came up. And I was just kind of fixated on it. So I went to kind of the traditional route, which often doesn't work, but I went to the PR people. I went to the communications people at the hospital and said, you know, I'd really like to meet with the doctors. I didn't really want to pitch it completely to the communications folks, although in retrospect, they ended up being incredible and really made this story possible. But I really wanted to pitch it to the decision makers, you know, the doctors and the – so I met with a few doctors and so I kind of said, here's my vision for this story that – We would follow a kid, you know, 3 to 6 to 12 months out from disclosure, and then would be in the room, you know, when the disclosure was made. And they were really open to it. I mean, I think they felt like they tend to work in solitude a little bit from the rest of the world. I mean, because this is an illness that is becoming less and less prevalent, and certainly kids are born with it less and less often. So I think they saw a lot of value in reminding people that there is this whole generation of children who are growing up with this. And they just do incredible work that deserved recognition. So I asked them for this, and the deal was is that they would float this to a parent whose kid was going to find out. And it wasn't long after the meeting I had with the primary doctor there that she, Kathy Ferrer is the doctor's name, she talked to Lee, and Lee was up for it. And so then I met with Lee at an IHOP, and we talked for 2 or 3 hours, and I didn't really even bring a notebook. It was just sort of me explaining the idea for the story and that we would work very hard to maintain their anonymity. And then really past then, I just started spending, you know, at least once a week, sometimes twice a week, sometimes more with the family, just kind of existing in their space.
Right. And what, how did you explain that? Because obviously she hadn't been told yet why, you know, she didn't know this was going to be focused on her being informed that she had HIV. So when before that, you know, critical meeting that you get to later in the story, how did you sort of explain to her, the girl that is, why, you know, why you were there, why you were following them around and being so present in their lives?
Sure. Well, so I had talked at some length with her mom about that, how I would say that. I made really clear that I couldn't lie to her, you know, and I wasn't going to lie to her, that I had to be clear that I was a journalist, that I worked for the Washington Post, and I showed her other stories that I had done and the newspaper and things like that, trying to make sure that she understood as well as she could who I was. And then I just said that I borrowed the language that her mother used, and that was a rare blood disease, is that I was writing a story about kids with this rare blood disease. And she didn't really require any more explanation beyond that. I mean, she so enjoyed having someone around who just paid attention to her and yeah. would sit there and watch SpongeBob with her all day. She didn't really wonder anymore past that. Well, I was fortunate in that way.
And what was that dynamic like? I mean, were you interacting with her a lot? Were you sort of a fly on the wall in a lot of these moments?
Well, I think the goal certainly was to be as much a fly on the wall as I could be. But I think, you know, that often just isn't reality, you know? I mean, you have to get people comfortable and to get people to sort of behave as they would if you weren't there. You can't always just be this person who sits in the corner, or at least you can't be in the beginning. And I think that at the beginning, it was very much just trying to connect with her. I mean, there were certainly times where I would put my notebook down because she wanted, you know, me to do something on a coloring book or just things like that. Or you know, there were times when she just insisted that I take a controller for a video game. And, you know, and that was part of the process of building trust, of her sure. getting used to me. You know, if I had sort of just been this awkward figure who stood in the corner and wouldn't engage, that would have made it worse. I mean, that would have made it less likely, I think, for her to act naturally. There, more often than not, when she would try to sort of lure me into the scene because she just wanted me to engage, I would always sort of resist it first because I'm obviously there to try to report a scene. And if I in any way become involved, then that blows up the scene. So it was certainly a balance. But I mean, the reality is that 90% of the time that I spent with them didn't appear in the story. And so much of that was just so that when the day came and the disclosure happened, that it wouldn't be strange for her or her mother that I was in the room. And that took a lot of time of just building trust and just her getting used to me. So yeah, that was really the strategy.
Did you feel yourself getting attached to JJ as you're doing this? I imagine you're around her so much and you're aware of what's going on with her.
Yeah, I think, you know, I tried to always kind of keep my journalist hat on. I think, you know, as much as I could. But certainly, you know, she was such a delightful kid. And she was so engaging and fun that, you know, it was impossible not to become attached on some level, both to her and her mother, just because, you know, you spend that much time with people. But, you know, certainly I was always conscious that, you know, I'm here to observe and to report. And you know, it helped that I almost always was taking notes, too, either in a notepad or on my phone. But certainly, yeah, it was impossible not to root for her and hope that it would go well.
According to the article on the Washington Post, it says that you followed her for 5 months and went with her to appointments. How long overall, start to finish, was this whole process of reporting this and writing and editing this story?
Let's see. So it's been a little while now. I mean, it was probably from, I think, when I started reporting to when the story published. Let me see. It was probably, I don't know, 8 months, I would say, from, you know, totally from beginning to end. That's kind of my best guess from memory. You know, because I really didn't start. I mean, I had some scenes sort of jotted down, but I didn't really start writing in earnest until it was done. And, you know, the writing process took a couple of weeks. And then, you know, we sort of went through design and the photographer, he had his own challenges, to deal with. Cause he obviously couldn't show her face. So he kind of came in really late in the process, to shoot the photographs. But yeah, I mean, it was 5 months of reporting and then, but then there was, you know, there was a lot of reporting, frankly, before I ever met her, because it was reading and sort of educating myself and then talking to these doctors and the PR team and all that. So, yeah, I would say from beginning to end, it was probably around 8 months.
So obviously this wasn't like a this wasn't a rushed story, but how did you know when you had enough? Like, how did you know, okay, I've recorded enough. I've been there through enough different appointments and meetings that I have what I need to really write the story.
Well, I think in some ways this was easier. That is often a really difficult thing to judge, but I knew that the climactic moment would be the disclosure. And at most, there would be one scene after that. So because I knew that the tension in the story is all drained out, basically, once they've done the disclosure, once she knows what she has and you've seen how she reacts in that moment or that day, the tension is gone, and you're only going to be able to keep the reader's attention for maybe one more section. It felt like that ending with that section wasn't quite real enough or true enough or sincere enough. So I felt like I needed one more section, and it worked out that she had a follow-up appointment. And, you know, I wasn't certain going into that if that would be the last scene. But when I saw it, you know, when it sort of played out, I knew right then, okay, this is clearly the ending.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about that key scene in the middle where you have the disclosure. One thing that struck me as I reread it before doing this interview was, you know, it's as you said, it's really like the critical part of the story. It's what it's at the heart of what this narrative is about, and yet when it happens, it struck me that it wasn't dramatic. There wasn't huge tears. Right. There wasn't screaming. There wasn't, you know, even raised voices. It's so quiet, so still.
Right.
How did you approach telling that or describing that scene, given everything that was at stake, but also how understated the moment was?
Well, I think, you know, for me, this story, I told it as straight as I've ever told any story. Because it could have, you know, if it had been over, it could have easily been overwrought, you know, because here you have a kid who's sick, and those stories often really go off the rails. And so I felt like I needed to tell this story really straight, just show, do very little telling. And, you know, I thought for me, there was enormous power in her quiet reaction, because, you know, by that point you knew in the story that she had a lot going on in her mind, that she'd had a lot of emotional problems, and she'd suffered with depression. She was on all these sort of different medications. And so knowing that context and then seeing her, this totally muted response, and then a little bit of a quiet unraveling, you know, as the day goes on, where she won't eat her food, and then when her sister asked her, how did it go? She says, I don't know. And then she just kind of has a little outburst when her mom says, you know, you need to go to your godmother's house. You know, but I just felt like I knew at that point, I knew her behavior so well, and I knew kind of what was normal, that I knew that this wasn't normal, because she's such an expressive kid. And for her to basically just totally shut down was very powerful to me. And I just felt like if I just tell this straight, I think it's really going to resonate with readers.
I think that definitely was how I took it, because it felt so real, in the sense that I think you even described very, you know, these little tiny details, like the fact that JJ kept her eyes down on the paper as she's kind of hearing some of this.
Right.
She's kind of absorbing this and processing this, and that you can almost get the sense that part of this is going to have to sink in for a while before she really starts to feel the weight of it.
Right. Yeah, and I think in some ways that was the value of, you know, 3 weeks later, you've seen her process it a little bit, and she comes with these questions that she ends up not asking, but you get a little sense of, like, because the reaction was so minimal that you at least get a little bit more insight, I think, into how her mind is working.
Mm-hmm. So let me back out a little bit and talk a little bit about just the writing process in this piece. How did you approach just getting this together and organizing everything you had? If, you know, it sounds like you had about 6-7 months worth of notes and research and you know, collected moments and scenes. How did you start to piece this together?
Yeah, that was tricky. And, my editor, Linda, played a huge role in that. And we had many, many discussions about structure. And, we knew where it was going to start. We knew that it had to start on the day of the disclosure, and that we would cut that scene right before the climactic moment, which is a kind of a traditional narrative approach. Mm-hmm. You start right immediately before the climactic moment and then stop. And then we had almost like two background sections. Mm-hmm. Here, which is unusual. And where one you have to sort of say who she is and her personal background and how she came to be adopted and her personality, and then there was the medical background. And I felt like those two sections couldn't work as one. They couldn't, those two sort of threads, they couldn't work in one section. So the second section is just her background in kind of a traditional sense. And then the third is her medical history, which I thought to me was really fascinating. And her central to the story is her struggle with medication. That's mm-hmm. really kind of the driver here.
Right.
So that kind of deserved its own section. And so I think we knew, I think, what those early sections would be. I had a really long section that that Linda smartly thought we should cut about, that was, I don't know how many words it was. It was probably over 1,000 words in the middle of the story that really kind of slowed it down. But it was a scene with her at her house and kind of interacting with a boy at the playground. And it just kind of slowed it down. And, we also thought the camera should move. It shouldn't all be her. And so it was nice to have a scene there at the hospital where they're preparing for the disclosure and where she's not there. And so we were trying to sort of get that rhythm right where, how do we tell you enough, without losing the reader before they get to the moment that they're really waiting for. And that was, how does she react, when she learns about this? Because, you're trying to sort of build up the stakes and explain the stakes, before then. So, The structure, I think, wasn't terribly difficult to come together with this one because we knew where we were going. But the hard part, I think, was choosing what to lose, definitely. And Linda was, hugely instrumental in that.
It's interesting that you mentioned that idea of like losing stuff. One thing I really admire about your writing, and particularly in this piece, is there's these really beautiful stretches that are just so minimal and very spare. But they're very powerful. So like one of my favorite snippets in the middle of the story, you're talking a little bit about how JJ is growing up in this adopted family. And I'm just going to read these three short lines. It says, "One day JJ erupted in their kitchen. She screamed and threw cups. She stomped on the floor. 'I want to kill myself,' the girl shouted. She was 7. Like that almost feels like a little poem or something. You've got these little sentences that are like 6 or 5 words each, that little tiny quote, and then a 3-word thing that just states her age, which punctuates that whole thing. I'm just wondering, how long did it take for you to craft that into that form? How many different iterations did like this little moment have to get to this?
Well, I knew that I wanted to lead to she was 7. Like, so I sort of started with that little section, or that little collection of sentences. I started with that mm-hmm. because I knew when that story had been recounted to me, that's what struck me, is how old she was in that moment, that she's saying, "I want to kill myself," that she's acting this way. And, I kind of used the, there's that old so journalism rule is that action with, active sentences, action where you're showing action, write short sentences, because they move more quickly. It goes back to, with this story especially, was just really writing it spare. And I'm glad you appreciate that, because I think there other writers might have done this a different way and it could have been done successfully other ways. But I felt like the details of her life were so powerful that I just needed to get out of the way and show them to you and just really put them in the right order. You know, like if you had known, I think some of the power of that construction would have been lost had you known first that she was seven, you know, a seven-year-old who did this or that or this or that. Seeing her behave in this really jarring, disturbing way and then learning that she's seven, I think just adds to the weight. And it was important, too, that I keep reminding readers how old she is. You know, this is this, it's like that scene with her mother and the psychiatrist when she just says, like, we have to remember she's just a little girl, you know. It was important that people keep, that I keep reminding readers of that.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, that's what was so powerful about that, that part of the story, because when you just end with that three-word sentence that says she was seven, I mean, I have an eight-year-old and a six-year-old daughter, and I can only imagine at their age for them to be dealing with this kind of stuff, and also just saying that at that age. Right. So that's why I feel like that's such a punch in the gut. There's another paragraph I was going to ask you about, which I really liked from a different standpoint, and this is where... Well, let me read it first, and then I can ask you about it. Sure. So this is also around that same part of the story where you're kind of giving the reader a background on what JJ's like, and you're talking about her. And it says, to her, JJ was just another kid who needed love. Ladybug, Lee called her then. JJ was trusting and kind, and her head's favorite spot was against her mom's shoulder. At three, she sang gospel hymns in church and danced in front of the pulpit. At five, she made silly videos in which she told stories about cucumbers and wiggled to a Waka Flocka flame song. She feared dogs and caterpillars and the mechanical mouse at Chuck E. Cheese's, but never the needles that took her blood. She mastered a pose that she still employs today, half-turned, hand on hip, elbow out, head cocked down, and a grin so immense it makes her cheeks swell like plums. I think at some point earlier, I looked at this, and I think there's like 14 details in that one paragraph. Mm-hmm. You know, little concrete, yeah, specific visual details that paint such a powerful picture of what this girl is and her personality and what that's like. And again, I'm just kind of curious, how long did it take you to craft this, or how do you get something this dense and rich? I mean, did this start as like 500 words and you just had to keep taking pieces away, or... You know, how did you get to this?
Well, I kind of like that. I'm sure I stole it from somebody, but I kind of like, I have the habit of doing that in profiles, stories like this, where I collect a bunch of different details that say something different about someone and then pack them into one dense graph. And I think for me, the goal anyway is that at the end of that paragraph, you have a really vivid sense of who this person is without all at once, you know, and sometimes we kind of stretch that over the course of a story. But I felt like it's like a one paragraph bio, where you're really seeing this person. And by the end of it, you understand them and the way they look and move and sound and their personality. And so I kind of I knew that paragraph was going to be in the story early on, and then I went hunting for those little details. You know, when she was three, and then when she was five, I was sort of looking for little moments in her life, details in her life that I could string together. And often, I find that if I have details that don't fit in the narrative, but that are really good, like the mechanical mouse. Like, it struck me that here's a kid, and I talked to her about this before, is that here's a kid who sort of proudly doesn't fear getting needles jammed in her arm often, all the time, but she is deathly afraid of this mechanical mouse at Chuck E. Cheese. And that juxtaposition early on struck me, and I said, okay, this is going to be somewhere, but it's not something that would fit in the natural flow of the telling of the story. Like, it didn't fit into a scene, and I had a lot of little details like that. Like, I'd seen these videos where she's you know, dancing, and her mother had told me before about her singing at church, and so I had kind of all these combinations. And I find often, if you just sort of pause at some point in the story and put them in one really fat paragraph, it can really resonate. And I think it can be very revealing all at once, because it's just like it's one big bite. And hopefully, you know, you walk away at the end, or you continue in the story with a very clear sense of who that person is.
So how much do you think about like the rhythm of your words or the rhythm of the writing? Or, yeah, I guess what I mean is like, or like the pace, I guess maybe. I mean, I was thinking about, you know, the example I had before this one where you had the short sentences with line breaks, and then you have this other one, which is this really dense paragraph that's packed with stuff. You know, is this something that you consciously think, I need to speed up the narrative now, I need to slow it down? Or is it just sort of as your certain things just call for it to have a different pace?
Yeah, no, I think I definitely spend a lot of time thinking about rhythm and pace, as does my editor. I have it helps to have an editor with a really good narrative ear and who thinks a lot about pace as well. And it was something in this story that both on a macro level were like section to section pacing, and then just on a more micro level, paragraph to paragraph, sentence to sentence, and, you know, word to word. Definitely think about that. And it's important, obviously, to alternate that, you know, to have moments where it's really moving quickly and then other moments where it's slowing down. Like, that is probably the slowest paragraph in the piece. But it's a piece that generally moves pretty quickly, because it's a lot of scene and dialogue. And, you know, dialogue, as Roy Peter Clark from Pointer always likes to say, is that, quote, slow stories down and dialogue speed stories up. And this is a story that is has almost no quotes or very few quotes, but a lot of dialogue. And that really moves quickly. So I think it's important, when you do have so much dialogue, so much scene, that you take moments to sort of pause and tell the reader something that they really need without disrupting those scenes.
So tell me a little bit about how you revised this story once you had like an initial draft. Was it a lot longer than it needed to be? Did you have to cut a lot? You know, what were some of the big decisions you had to make to get this into a final form?
Yeah, no, it was definitely too long, the initial version, for sure. And it helps to have an editor that you really trust. That's such a key thing, I think, for any reporter, but especially when you're writing narrative that is... it can be subjective about what scenes you keep and what scenes you lose. And so, you know, I wanted her to see an early version that had a couple of scenes that I didn't know if we should keep or not. And ultimately, you know, we did clip that one really big scene. But it definitely served the story. I mean, it was I debated a little bit with Linda. She was absolutely right. I mean, in that scene, just it was just right in the middle, and it slowed it down. And we were just trying to be so conscious of, you know, how long can we wait to deliver the moment? And we really didn't want to get there too quickly, but we definitely didn't want to make people wait too long, because they would just get impatient. there was definitely details that I loved and that just had to go. And that's always painful.
Is there a way that you're able to kind of just have a rule or something that lets you figure out, you know, that if this doesn't do a certain thing for moving the story forward, it goes? I imagine you're obviously an experienced journalist and you've gone through this a lot of times. How do you make that final call that, like, I love this piece, but it's got to go?
I think reminding yourself of what the sort of the story central themes. What is this story about? Like, sort of saying that over and over and over. Like, what is this story really about? And then applying that to the scene or the detail or the sentence or whatever it is. Even if you love it, if it's not serving like a very, very clear purpose, and if it's not on theme in some way, or it's not revealing something new about that core theme, it probably needs to go. You know, it probably needs to go. And this scene that I had, a portion of it anyway, it's a good example. It was about her interaction with this little boy in the playground, and it sort of spoke to her future about well, you know, what is her dating life going to be like in a few years? And it just was a little bit far afield from the central theme. And, you know, that's why I think ultimately it would have hurt the story, mm-hmm. even though I liked writing it. but it just wasn't.
So the story was published in September of last year, September 18th. Mm-hmm. First, I'm curious, what was the reaction of JJ and her mother to the story?
So Lee, you know, loved the story. I mean, she did. I mean, I don't always do this, but they had given me such enormous, put it such enormous trust in me and given me this incredible access that I basically read her the whole story before it ran. In part so that if there was anything that was inaccurate, she would say, hey, that's not right. Or if she thought there was a detail that would reveal her identity or her daughter's identity, that she could raise that with me. And because I just really didn't want her to pick up the paper and be surprised by anything in that piece. I owed them that. So, you know, she liked it. Yeah, she did. And JJ has not read the story yet because her mom just wants her to get a little bit more mature because it's into a lot of, obviously, you know, people who've died with this illness and, you know, a lot of the challenges that she'll face when she's older. So I think, you know, she's waiting for the right time to show her the story. But, you know, I've stayed in touch with them, and I wrote a short follow-up a couple of months ago. You know, now that she has transitioned, she's actually transitioned on to taking her pills, which was a big step. So, you know, and I see them as a family that I'll continue to stay in touch with and write about potentially for years, because mm-hmm. there was a. You know, there was a huge reaction from readers, I think, you know, parents, mm-hmm. People who desperately wanted to help or to pray for her or to just tell her they cared. And mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think it's definitely a story that I'll keep up with.
Yeah. Tell me a little more about that. Tell me about the reader responses to that. You know, what were some of these things that you were hearing from people?
Yeah, I mean, people, I think, were, you know, deeply moved by her story, and they just really wanted to know. I think overwhelmingly was the question I got was, when are you going to write an update? Because they were rooting for her. I mean, clearly they just wanted her life to turn out well, and, you know, there were a lot of people who had similar situations. They were raising children with illnesses, in some cases children with HIV, and I think they were comforted to know that they weren't alone in this. But yeah, overwhelmingly, it was just kind of that, hey, I want to know how this kid turns out. And we felt like until something changed, it wasn't worth writing about, you know, to sort of remind people that she's still struggling with her medication. And it was really when she, it was really when she made this breakthrough and that she had fully transitioned from her liquid medications to the pills that we decided, okay, I think now's the time to write a follow-up story.
Well, this story was really an incredible read, and the follow-up is really fascinating as well. And I really appreciate your time talking with me about it. So once again, thanks so much for coming on the show. This has really been
a great
conversation.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Matt.
Thanks so much again to John for coming on the podcast. Really enjoyed our conversation. A couple closing thoughts on this story. Number one, I think John Woodrow Cox's writing in this piece is some of the best that I've seen in a while, particularly in the craft of details and description. I talked about it during the podcast, but if you go back and read this, there's just scene after scene where he writes little tiny details about what the person's doing or what they're wearing, what's happening in the moment. And it just makes everything come alive. This doesn't feel melodramatic or artificial. This feels like a very real girl who's going through a very critical moment in her life. And by virtue of the writing in this piece that really shows her so much about her without us even knowing her real name, it brings us into what this story is really about. Secondly, I think this is also a great example of almost like a perfectly structured story. We're introduced in the opening scene to what's at stake, what's about to happen. And as he mentioned during the interview, the story brings us right up to the point where the critical disclosure of her illness to her is about to happen. Then we go back and we find out more about who she is and how she got to that moment. We learn pretty much everything that happened in those 10 years up to this big meeting at the hospital. And so by the time we come back later in the story to her learning that she has HIV, it's hard not to feel very engaged with her and care about her as a person and as a character in this narrative. And then, of course, the story goes from there and shows you the aftermath and what happens and the slow effect that this closure has on JJ. I love that this story didn't try to tie it up in a bow. It didn't try to provide a happy, everything's going to be fine ending. It leaves it somewhat real and ambiguous. And so much so that, as John indicated in the interview, people kept asking him, well, what happened? And that's why there's another story that came out this year that updated where she was at a year after this. So he mentioned it in the interview. I've linked to it in the show notes. So if you've been interested in this interview and if you read the first piece, you'll definitely want to check out the second story. It's shorter, but it gives you an update on what JJ's going through and where she's at today. That's it for this week. Look forward to catching you next time. Until then, this is Matt Pusateri, and thanks for listening to the Nonfiction Podcast.